Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's look at the papers first. A bit of a kind of what you might call a Sunday miscellany of front pages today. I'll start with the Sunday Mirror. 26 women killed since Aisling. Females living in fear of violence as victim Paula is laid to rest. That is Paula Canty, who was brought home to Kinsale yesterday for her funeral. The story by John Kearns and Nicola Donnelly. Women feel even less safe 3 years on from the murder of Aisling Murphy. Up to 26 women died violently here since Joseph Pushka killed her in January 2022. And Women's Aid Chief Sarah Benson said women in Ireland are not any safer since Aisling's death. And you will remember, of course, that poor Aisling Murphy's death was going to change everything. The Sunday Times is leading with that Jules Thomas, the former partner of Ian Bailey, is taking on the streaming giant Netflix in High Court action in Dublin this week, in quotes from her, "to clear my name." She reiterates that she had nothing to do with the murder in West Cork 28 years ago, and also pictures there on the front page of the Palisades fire in Los Angeles. The Irish Mail on Sunday has trolley crisis caused 2,500 deaths in 2024. So this is a kind of an annual story now, but just a kind of a health warning. It's based on that statistic that for every 82 people who spend more than 6 to 8 hours in A&E, one of them dies within 30 days. So it's a notional. I'm sure that statistic could be true, but it is a story extrapolated from figures, if you know what I mean. They also have an Offaly there. Healy Rays would take ministry if offered one. Isn't that good of them? And then they also have Meghan and Harry comfort Inferno victims, to which you might be glib and say, have these people not suffered enough? But anyway, the Irish Sun on Sunday, FBI to test Sophie's clothes, Bailey's DNA part of new probe. So this story was in the Indo yesterday. The FBI will test Ian Bailey's DNA against the bloody clothing of Sophie Tuscan Duplanty, and the clothes have been sent to the US by Gardaí for that. The Sunday Independent have a poll, and the headline they're taking out of that is that this poll, they say, suggests that the public don't want the Fianna Fáil Fine Gael coalition talking to Michael Lowry. And finally, the Business Post have an exclusive, which is that construction magnates Maurice Regan and Luke Comer have agreed to provide fresh finance to Michael Flatley to rescue him from a receivership battle over his County Cork estate, the Business Post can reveal. They also, below the fold, government talks intensify as parties near coalition deal, growing expectation that there be a new government formed by January 22nd. Okay, my panel today, Sinead McSweeney is a former global head of public policy at Twitter. Sarah McGuinness is political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Gerard Howland is a public affairs advisor and an Irish Times columnist. And Graham Finlay is assistant professor of politics and international relations at UCD. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brendan.
So, Graham, you lived in LA for quite a while in various places around the kinds of places we've seen mentioned this past week. We just heard Brentwood on the news there. I think you lived in Brentwood. What was it like for you watching, as we all did, the fires all week?
I mean, this is really unlike anything else you've seen in LA in terms of fires. And yeah, we were there at various times. My youngest son was born in LA. We were living in Altadena in particular on September 11th, which was quite a while ago. And we've lived in Altadena a couple times since then. So whether it's Altadena, where I'm virtually certain that the houses we stayed in have been burnt down, the fire is encroaching on the public library I used to walk my son to, like in a stroller, which is in Altadena. But then in Brentwood and Pacific Palisades, I mean, if you can do this on Google Street View. You can start at the Getty Center, which was where we were, and take Sunset Boulevard, which is where we were living, and just take it all the way down to the coast heading west. And you go through Pacific Palisades, you go by the high school, which, big celebrities hold, benefits for and things like that, and like the Eagles and things like that.
Yeah.
And then You know, you go by the luxury mall, which was saved by using private firefighters. And then you get down to Malibu, where the Getty Center, where they keep their classical collections down in Malibu, is very much menaced by these fires. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And it's all gone, except for that luxury shopping center. You know, it's hard to imagine what it's like. Like I said, if you go on Google Street View, you'll see what it was like. But it's gone. And yeah. It's just, again, it's really something which even accustomed to fires burning uncomfortably
close. So fires
close.
These fires are part of life in LA to some extent.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you know, the Santa Ana winds are very hot winds, which are quite forceful winds, which blow through a very, very dry area. I mean, which is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. So they knew this was going to, something was going to happen. And over the past few years, I've been able to see sort of quite serious fires burning near the Getty Center. People might have seen there's a highway going to the valley from Brentwood, Bel Air, Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a big multi-lane highway. And you'll see fires casually, well, they'd be burned, not casually, but burning on either side of it quite frequently over the last bunch of years. But they've always been contained, whereas these are still not, for the most part, contained. And they're really, really devastating. The loss of houses is hard to compare with. You know, a lot of the other houses which have disappeared are farther north of Los Angeles in sort of more semi-rural areas. And then they might be wildfires, whereas these started in pretty close to urban areas and are really consuming urban areas.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I saw footage last night of a fire coming up the hill, and these tiny little, they were like dinky cars that were the fire trucks on a road over it. And as the fire came, they realized, okay, we need to get out of here. They didn't even get everything out. They didn't, even the fire trucks and trailers didn't get out of there, and they were just consumed. But the size of the fire next to these little fire trucks, you just thought, there's the power of nature, unbound, really.
I mean, you see a line of cars fleeing down east down Sunset Boulevard, which, you know, eventually got stopped by refugees from the Palisades fire. You know, eventually were stopped and people abandoned their cars and they had to bulldozer them off to the side of the road so fire trucks could get through. I mean, it's really, really crazy.
Yeah. Sarah McGinnis, were you watching this all week?
Yeah, I was. I was actually off sick for part of this week. So, like, you know, you kind of just like mindlessly throw on whatever, like the news, or if you're scrolling
whatever
on content, social media.
Whatever content is flowing in.
But
even
like looking to escape, and like anyone, you know, like working in news, often like when I get home, the last thing I want to think about is what's going on in the world. So you throw on something mindless, like maybe you scroll on TikTok or Instagram or whatever. But this story is one that you just can't escape. Because it's so like in your face, and not like of course it is, but like even like scrolling on TikTok, which would usually kind of be a bit of an escape, like kind of, you know, like you see babies and puppies and, you know, all lovely things in life. But this time it was seeing kind of like influencers, like people who generally would like promote content like fashion hauls or whatever, you know, in floods of tears because they've been evacuated from their house, or like videoing, you know, this. There was one influencer in particular who actually has a brand who is it got into controversy recently because she said it was far more sustainable than it actually was, and actually talking about climate change for once, saying, oh my God, guys, this is really fully crazy. Like, I'm in a hotel, I've been evacuated from my home, but now the fire is coming towards the hotel. She thankfully is safe, as is her family. But, you know, it's just a really stark reminder.
So it's interesting. As much as we should care more about the effects of climate change thus far tend to be in the poorest countries of the world, do you think, in a way, for the online generation, has this been a bit more of possibly a make you think about climate change moment because it feels a bit closer to home and closer to the kind of people and stuff you're seeing online all the time?
Yeah, definitely. And even like it was on some social media platform, and I'm paraphrasing here, but there was kind of a quote which it actually quite kind of stuck with me because it's genuinely playing out right now. It's kind of, you know, climate change is a phenomenon that will sneak up on you. And at first you're viewing it through your mobile phone, but eventually it'll be you who's taking the content that someone else is going to be viewing, you know, like you're going to be looking directly at it. And, you know, that just is kind of stark because, you know, that's certainly what's happening for people in LA now. You know, they might have watched whatever phenomenon, even like, say, people, Hurricane Helene in Florida, the devastation that that caused another extreme weather event. You know, like people are, it is consistently getting closer to home, and it's slightly problematic, but definitely true that people in kind of wealthier countries seem to empathize with people from similar backgrounds more. Like, I'd say there's a lot more empathy and kind of attention being paid to this because it's it's in a country whereby, you know, we feel like we have a connection to. Yeah, there are plenty of Irish people living in LA.
Gerard, I think the language you're using around this is that these fires were not caused by climate change, but that they were certainly exacerbated and fanned, if you will, by climate change.
Yes, and climate change is the context in which they are happening, in the sense that extreme weather events are becoming more and more frequent, and the winds in Los Angeles are a subset of that. It's not a direct cause and effect. If you look at our cold spell here in the last few days, in the last week, it's not a record-breaking event, by the way, but it is another example of how bursts of Arctic air coming south over our island. And why? Because the flows in the Atlantic northwards that traditionally kept that very cold weather away are becoming increasingly more variable.
One thing,
the port of Holyhead closed for us outside our island, but important point of access for our economy and for our people. So if you took at our weather event this week, if you look at Los Angeles, if you look at Holyhead, I should say, so from Holyhead to Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
These things are happening more frequently.
The other thing we saw was the we're seeing is the cost of this. And it's gone everything from $50 billion to $200 billion for this one event alone. And maybe it's easier for us to see when it is, see fine houses being eviscerated. I think I saw a figure that the total cost of like these kind of freak climate change weather events last year was $750 billion. But clearly, like I'd say that this one is half of that already, probably by the time it's done.
Very probably. I mean, the Getty Museum is one of the greatest treasuries on earth. It would be the equivalent of the library in Alexandria burning, were that a catastrophe to happen. You'd wonder how long the world insurance business is going to be stable. And I think, you know, we in Ireland are not particularly well provided for in terms of extreme weather events. And I'm reminded of a speech the governor of the central bank gave last May. And in that speech, he said, getting to net zero is our most cost effective option.
Okay, so we tend to focus we think of it as a cost.
We think that we're doing some act of altruism for the world by doing this. It is a vital necessity to urgently serve our own interest.
Okay, Sinead McSweeney.
Yeah, I like everybody else was looking on, and it's kind of hard to comprehend the level of devastation. You know, when you see these kind of desolated blocks rather than just one building, but actually those aerial views of blocks. And I have former colleagues who live in LA, and just, you know, seeing them post, oh, we've received an evacuation warning, and then you're wondering how they are, and just remembering, you know, that human element. And it's not just big Hollywood stars, it's those who work for Hollywood stars, those who, you know, people in the service industry, and it's not just the big houses,
there seems to be a trailer park in Pacific Palisades as well, Palisades Hollow or something. Graham, were you familiar with it? But it seemed to be like very ordinary people, kind of surfer dudes and all this, who were living there in their trailers. And
yeah, I mean, that's what I love about LA is it's such a mix of people. Now, it is in many ways very much segregated by class, but you do have these pockets, and you certainly have people who work on those big houses. One of the things I used to do was chase the taco trucks around, you know, with the same stroller, and because there are guys working on building sites and on gardens, you know, all over the Brentwood and various places like that. But, you know, one of the stories I saw was a guy who walked his horses from northern Altadena to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, where they have a very big college football game every year. And, you know, these were regular guys who were sort of, you know, in a very small house in a semi-rural area at the very extreme north of, up against the mountains in Altadena. You know, and that's, you know, now they've lost everything except for their horses and pets. And, you know, that it reminds you that there are lots of ordinary people, you know, involved in this as well.
Graham, before we move on from this, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times. I mean, we had our own not comparable at all kind of weather event this week. But this piece by Patrick O'Donoghue, Ireland is not prepared for more extreme weather events, caught your eye?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and what beyond the snow and so forth, and we really have to think about
You're from Canada.
I am from Canada,
just,
right? Where all the snow, you know, is cleared before you think about going to work, you know, because they have an army of snow plows and salt and all sorts of things like that. I don't know if we necessarily need that, since we seem to get snow every 10 years. Maybe one for the Selly Gap, which whenever someone is told it's impassable, there's always someone who's going to go up and try and find out and has to be rescued. But what I think is really striking about that article is the threat of coastal erosion and flooding, which is a much, much greater threat and has been identified by AirGrid as its biggest threat. And if you're thinking about buying a house on the coast, or if you just happen to go near the coast, you should look at this 1 meter sea level rise flood map, which you can find online, which will show the impacts on projected impacts on all sorts of areas of Ireland. And if you're looking at the Dart, look how close it is to the sea level and how a storm surge would affect your commute.
Yeah. But also bear in mind that as much as a lot of people not very well insured on their houses in LA, and look at it varies. But you will not get flood insurance in a lot of areas in around the Dublin Bay there. People don't have it anymore.
Say,
so if it does happen, people will be wiped out.
As they say in the article, the coastal management plan has been long fingered, which is a problem.
Sarah, briefly.
And there's an interesting piece by Sean Moynihan in the Mail on Sunday, and there's just a really stark warning in it. Sean Moynihan, the CEO of Alone, who was kind of talking about how they assisted the elderly and how, you know, the elderly need to be kind of made a priority in the next government. But there's quite a stark line where he said that we cannot live in emergency mode forever. You cannot run a society on emergency mode. And I think that is true for certainly what happened this week, you know, like kind of relying on farmers to get tractors to deliver medication to people. It's completely absurd, you know, and it's just to kind of go, just it kind of links in to what Graham was saying about the fact that we're not ready for this. I think it just
I guess they are. It happens all the time in Canada, so they're well set up for it. It's rare enough here so far. Anyway, I want to move on because there's lots more to get through today. Sinead McSweeney, with your former global head of public policy, a Twitter hat on, you picked Colin Murphy in the Sunday Independent. We need to talk about Elon, and we certainly do, don't we?
Yeah, unfortunately, from my point of view. I think maybe it would be better if the world stopped talking about him a little bit.
Do you think, yeah?
Yeah, because I think he thrives on the attention. And I think similar to Trump, there's a risk that, you know, we talk about, Elon Musk poses a threat to democracy here in Europe because he had the leader of AfD on for an interview on his own
Twitter feed.
His Twitter feed. But actually, you know, the vast majority of people didn't see that, but they will have read the vast coverage of it since. And it's a little bit like what happened with Trump in terms of the extent to which we amplify the threat in terms of how we approach it. So,
but he is the richest man in the world. He has huge levels of engagement, maybe, you know, not by everybody.
Yeah.
But he does have huge levels of engagement on social media, which is the currency now in politics. So he is very powerful.
He is very powerful. But I also think that we need to talk about it in a different way.
Okay.
And I think we need to recognise that he does pose a threat, that what he's doing is dangerous. But there's an extent to which we're kind of sitting around admiring and analysing the problem rather than moving to, well, what does this mean and how do we address it? I mean, there's still an extent to which we kind of deify or idolise him or have this belief that, you know, he's kind of all powerful. What struck me about Colin's piece was that it kind of very accurately kind of cut down to some of the core pieces of Musk's personality. You know, there's an inconsistency or in the moment approach that Musk takes to what he says or what he does in any particular moment.
So it's all very impulsive, is it?
It's entirely impulsive. There's no overall coherence or consistency aside from his, you know, seeking to kind of populate the world and mainly by himself, but also encouraging others to do it. And possibly the trip to Mars, you know, there's very
climate
little
change. Yes, although interestingly, core value for him or fighting climate change.
Well, I would query whether he has any core values, but he has been a kind of an outlier in that kind of libertarian right wing think, in that he wasn't a climate change denier. However, this week he has kind of jumped on the political bandwagon. In terms of LA and kind of saying, oh, well, it's not, that's not climate change.
Attacking,
that's something
Newsom
else. It's Newsom and it's political.
Kamir, can I ask you a question? So I know you didn't know him well or anything, but you had certain dealings with him. Colin Murphy's notion, to what you were saying there, that he's fundamentally a gamer, and that is that this is the gamification of the world, basically, by him. Yeah. Does that make sense to you from what your experience of him?
Yes. Yes. I think like he's impulsive. He's in the moment. He makes his I remember him once. I spoke to him for an hour once. Right. So that's the extent of my dealings with him, other than
look, you're
nowhere
ahead of most of us. So go on, you're the expert there.
And I mean, his approach is that. He makes hundreds of decisions in a day. And as the more he knows about a topic, you know, the odds that he's batting average is good. Increase.
Okay. And he accepts this.
That is the way his approach. And you can see that this week with the whole Farage stuff, you know. And even I heard Nigel Farage interviewed yesterday, where he was saying, oh, no, I've been talking to him since, everything's grand now.
Mm. He was supporting Reform UK.
Yeah.
Then because Farage didn't agree with him about a guy called Tommy Robinson, who is in prison, a far right guy.
Yeah.
Musk then decided Farage is not the right person to lead Reform UK and need to get rid of him.
But now he thinks he's fine. And so that's the way he works. And I mean, Colin finishes off his article with saying, you know, sometimes he's right, but not always. And that was a phrase that I used to have about Musk as well, where, you know, a stopped clock is right twice a day. You know, there's an extent to which, because he's the richest man in the world, we attribute this, well, he must be right and he must be smarter than us. But actually, he's not. But he just, the volume of money that he has behind him has given him a place that you know, people aren't sufficiently questioning of him and of his approach.
You see, Graham, that worries me then, because it sounds like we can't predict. It's chaotic. It's kind of Trump again. These people thrive on chaos. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's like the world's richest Twitter troll, although I think the gamification question is a really, really interesting perspective. I think what we're seeing is the colonization of our actual real-world democracy and public sphere by the trolls of the internet. And
you would agree with that, you're nodding. Yeah,
I agree with that. And I mean, I can come back again.
Yeah,
but
okay.
This is my point about, we need to move from admiring the problem to solutions.
Okay. Right,
but the solutions, and we saw in the last election, you know, the influence of online personalities, but maybe more substantive than just a few tweets here and there, like Joe Rogan. But, you know, obviously the cure for some of this is very, very difficult, both in terms of protecting freedom of expression, but also in terms of the backlash you get from these very, very powerful tech bros, right? So the prospect of a broligarchy as opposed to a democracy is very real. On the other hand, I have some hope, which is that even without controls on content, which we're seeing slip away in Meta and places like that, that people in Germany, who many of whom were already going to vote for the Alternative for Deutschland, you know, before Musk had an interview with the leader of it, you know, will see Musk for who he is, as a guy who's completely uninformed about Germany and about AfD. And I wonder how many people he can get to the polls beyond who would come out anyway.
Okay. Sarah, on a related note then, Graham mentioned the Meta issue there. You picked a piece in the Business Post, make no mistake, Meta going MAGA sends spells serious trouble for Ireland.
Yeah, so this is by Charlie Taylor in the Business Post today, and Charlie makes the kind of very valid point that, you know, there's actually an accompanying piece on the same spread by Sarah Collins, where she's kind of saying Brussels is kind of torn over whether to stand up to Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, who, you know, are kind of rowing back on fact-checking measures and, you know, arguably could face like sanctions under new EU laws, which the EU have spent the last couple of years firming up to make sure that big tech aren't, you know, kind of being let loose. So Charlie kind of makes the point that you know, with the EU kind of still trying to grapple between this, the US clearly on one side, Ireland is kind of piggy in the middle. You know, it's the this issue has been well covered in across all the Sunday papers today, and many of them kind of mention Ireland as this gateway to Europe for the US. Mm. But, you know, our position kind of becomes a bit more, you know, we are a small country. We are an economy that will have to watch very closely as to what the next president of the United States is going to do. And I suppose with the EU, kind of like, we can't really go on our own because we are so dependent on the EU. But in a similar vein, you know, like if we kind of buy into the US, are we like, it's a difficult situation to be in. And Charlie doesn't really propose an answer, and I don't have one now. But I suppose...
No, because our answer up to now is sure, everybody loves us and we kind of managed to dodge between the things. But is there a fault line here? Gerard, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday. Media regulator yet to move on big tech firms despite 300 complaints. So can I just ask you a broader question here? Mm. It seems like there's an interesting thing happening here to what Sarah was saying, right? Which is that, so Zuckerberg, in conjunction with saying about we're giving up on fact-checking and all that, he said, together with Donald Trump, our president, to who is now pledging undying fealty, we are going to kick back against Europe on regulation, right? So they're going to clearly make it very uncomfortable for Europe to regulate. And we haven't regulated the tech companies up to now. We've sleepwalked into letting them become this powerful. And then I was thinking, when they are regulated, they do back down. X backed down in Brazil when regulators did stand up against it. So does Europe have to kind of, you know, show a bit of balls here now and fight this?
Yep. I suppose Ireland is in a particular position. I mean, Comisión na Mban is a very new organisation. It's essentially finding its feet. I'm not going to, you know, kick them because they haven't been hyper busy on this yet, but they will need to show form sooner rather than later. It puts us at the sharp edge of an issue because many of these organisations are based here. They have a substantial presence here. And our regulatory function is disproportionately important to them and also within Europe. In terms of Europe generally, of which we are ultimately a subset, either we have values or we don't. I think we have an instinct to know that the only way you can deal with a bully is to stand up. It's not to try and compete with them on their own terms. I mean, it's an old analogue memory of mine, you know, going back to childhood. You don't compete with somebody on their terms, you're doomed to lose. And I think we have to maintain our composure, our presence of mind, that we are a society that believes in law. It may not be the instant kickback in the hour, you know, this sort of thing that you have to rise and fall the news cycle every hour, you know, a new sort of digital emission. That'll get you nowhere except worry you to death. I think we need a substantive rules-based, law-based approach to this that sticks and over a number of years, hopefully. By the end of this Trump presidency, we will not have gone backwards. We may have gone forwards. We will at least have held our own, and that our values, if still under attack, will have been maintained.
Okay, even if we've lost some jobs in the process.
Well, and there's a whole other mix of things happening between us, the US, between the US and the EU, and all of this will congeal together.
Sinead, the other thing I think that the Zuckerberg lining up with Trump in this way to fight European regulation shows that they clearly are afraid of regulation, these companies. We think they're all powerful, but they clearly are afraid of it, and they know it'll cost them so much money to have to put in the kind of checks and balances you should have if you've got a massive media company all over the world. So they are afraid, are they?
They are and they aren't. I would say Musk is definitely doesn't like regulation across any of his industries.
Facebook, but is it a fear for them? Was it when you were in Twitter, was regulation a great fear for you?
No, I mean, Twitter was always slightly different. I remember a public policy, senior public policy person from another tech company telling me that I wasn't suited for public policy because I was overly solution oriented in meetings, and that I really should just, you know, get on with kind of telling them what they wanted to hear and leaving the meeting. So, you know, I would say Twitter was slightly different from that point of view. My view was always that regulation was required for exactly the reasons that we're seeing playing out, which is that, you know, for that leaving these decisions around content and what free speech is and how it's vindicated to a couple of tech bros was never going to be a good idea. And that we did require governments to move out of the inertia that we saw for, you know, 5, 10, 8 years and actually lay down regulation. But at the end of the day,
do you think that might happen now?
Well, I think they have, you know, there is the Digital Services Act and, you know, not just that, but individual laws like NetzDG in Germany, France has robust laws, UK has robust laws. So individual countries have done it as well. But in terms of how much of a how much this actually means from Meta this week, I mean, my first reaction was like shock horror. You know, billionaire, you know, makes a decision that protects his business and his profit. But if you take that to its logical conclusion, he will do the same when it comes to how he operates in Europe. And these companies are very good at compartmentalizing how their products and companies operate in different parts of the world. So I don't see him going kind of toe to toe in a big you know, taking on European regulators. He will do what's required, as Facebook have always done in countries around the world, to protect the business and protect the bottom line.
OK, we'll take a break. Graham Finlay, Gerard Howland, Sarah McGuinness and Sinead McSweeney staying with us. Welcome back. Sinead McSweeney, Sarah McGuinness, Gerard Howland and Graham Finlay still with us. Gerard Howland, I feel that you have insights and know things that the rest of us don't know around government formation. So can you give us the skinny on where you think it's at right now? But you know what I'm curious about as well? Why did they take 2 weeks off and suddenly now it's like, oh, we're burning the midnight oil. We think we can get there for January 22nd and everything. Why didn't they start this a week earlier than they started it?
Well, I think one good reason was just physical, psychological exhaustion. These people had been working overtime for months. They had the intensity of an election. It wasn't a bad thing to take a break, by the way.
Okay.
Better decisions can be made. And I know it's a bit of a sort of public thing about, oh, they're on holidays. These people are never on holidays. And people in the media who cover politics closest know that. So I wouldn't have a problem with the break.
But have they kind of belatedly realised now that people get very impatient
no.
with them if there isn't a government by January 22nd and have suddenly said we need to get there and so burn the midnight oil?
No, I don't think that's the dynamic. I think there is a reasonable view that government does need to be formed. If it can be done by the 22nd, well and good. If it takes a little longer, that's going to have to be fine
probably
too.
It shouldn't be done in a hurry either, should it?
No, not particularly.
Yeah.
There isn't a mad rush, actually. And I wouldn't be fussed about 1, 2 or 3 weeks more. That's definitely not the issue.
Okay. Where do you think it's at?
So where it's at is they're making rapid progress on a whole range of issues that exclude any issue that might be contentious. So there's a lot of ground being covered, but the ground that's been covered is all on the flat.
Housing, disability, etc.
And they haven't attempted any of the jumps yet.
Okay.
So actually...
what are the jumps?
I think the jumps are going to be perhaps a couple of key issues around roads versus public transport and so on. But I think also particularly as between the three groups in play, the Healy Rays, the regional independents, versus Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, what will be the divvy out between them? In relation to...
Will we have a Healy Ray minister?
You may have, but I think there's a danger that Healy Rays are looking for turkey, but they're only being offered chicken. you know, are they going to go in with one minister of state as distinct from a super junior? If they get a super junior, the view of the regional independents who are looking for a senior cabinet position anyway is that with 8 TDs, excluding Verona Murphy, who's now the Count Corla, they are certainly entitled in those circumstances for the senior cabinet post that they were looking for. So the Healy Rays are having at least two effects on the overall dynamic. On the one hand, by very wisely, astutely bringing them in, what the government parties are doing is they are diluting the ultimate influence of the regional independents and their capacity in a scenario to either to stop dead a particular policy direction or even to threaten the life
so
of the
actually
government.
two would give them in extremis would give them a majority.
It's an emergency option.
Okay.
you know.
I think a lot of people did wonder why are they bolting them on as well. Okay, I see now. Yeah.
Exactly.
Options.
So that's one option. Yeah. That's one reason. And of course, tactically, that's very smart. And obviously, the regional independents can see that a mile off as well.
Furious, are they?
Well, I wouldn't say they're furious. This is politics. There's no point in being furious about facts and numbers.
Yeah.
It's a transactional business. But I think what the Healey Rays are doing is they are inflating the market. Because whatever dose two get, the other eight must proportionately get more.
So they have to get four times?
I'm not saying four times. Yeah. I'm sure the regional independents might say that, Brendan. I won't say it.
Okay. Yeah.
But that will be the discussion. And none of those discussions have proceeded. Then there's a further discussion between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael about, first of all, what is the shape of departments? And that's not clear, nor has it been decided. And secondly, when those departments are shaped, who gets what? And then is there actually one of them has to go to the regional group? How many of the super junior posts at cabinet table are going to either the Healey Rays or to the regional independents? And none of those things on this Sunday morning, I understand, are decided.
OK, because the cynics would say that's what they're actually talking about now. They're not talking
about... No, I think in these meetings that are going on, I understand from 10 o'clock this morning, they are going through all the policy areas, and this is well out there, so it's no particular insight, and Sarah will know more than me, is that this programme for government will be marked by its banality. And it will be lacking in a lot of specificity on a lot of issues.
OK, Sarah, what can you tell us, or what do you know?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, like the programme, like for two parties which, you know, leak like sieves at kind of any given opportunity, there hasn't really been a lot of kind of specifics being coming out from the programme for government meetings. So all we really can kind of speculate is the kind of power plays that are going on there, you know, like the kind of battles for certain departments or whatever you're having yourself. I think, you know, ultimately what kind of is interesting about this will kind of be, you know, the role of the independents in all of this. And like the configuration of the next government is ultimately going to have to change because the last time they were going into power with the Greens. So a lot of kind of portfolios were kind of lumped together, you know, like the Catherine Martin was in charge of tourism, culture, arts, the Gael talked, you know, like a very unwieldy portfolio. Same with Roderick O'Gorman. He was in charge of children, integration, equality. So my understanding is like a lot of focus now is going to be on kind of reconfiguring that to a space that makes more sense for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and also for the kind of centre-right independents that they're bringing on with them as well. So they're kind of trying to, you know, shake things up and put kind of the puzzle together in a way that makes sense for, that will suit the needs of the independents so that they can kind of dole out those junior ministries. But
did
also,
they expect before the election to be going into government with Labour?
They did. And this was something that I was only kind of thinking about today when looking at the Sunday Independent poll, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute. Now, maybe I'm just too close to it and potentially think about it too much. But, you know, the kind of working assumption was before the election that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will be returning to power, most likely with the Labour as their third party. You know, Micheál Martin had said it in maybe two interviews prior to the election. He had kind of said, I want Labour as the coalition partner. Simon Harris wasn't as forthcoming with that information, but the general sense from the backbenches was, we need a third party for stability. Don't really have too much interest in the independents. But it just kind of seems like overnight that changed. I remember I think it was the Tuesday after the election, I was like, you know, kind of doing like just calls around the backbenches, and particularly within Fianna Fáil, it was like a switch had flicked and they were kind of like, Labour, maybe, I don't really know. But here, listen, Michael Lowry is getting some of his lads together and we're definitely going to be talking to them. It was so instantaneous, this kind of like, you know, switch over. And, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's a case of we weren't asking the right questions before, we weren't looking at the independents closely enough. But definitely it kind of took me by surprise. And I'm kind of wondering, I suppose, if people who voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael did so with the expectation that they would be going in with kind of a centre-left coalition partner.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Although, yeah, well, that poll, which we'll come to in a sec, suggests people are happy enough with the makeup or a majority are. Sinead McSweeney, you've done your time in the trenches as an advisor.
Yeah.
Have you dealt with independence in that in your time?
Yeah, actually, the original Healy Ray, Jackie.
Oh, yeah.
He was an independent in the government from 97 to 2002.
Indeed.
Mr. Howland here was also in the trenches at that time.
You were advisor to, at that point?
The Minister for the Marine, Michael Woods.
Okay.
So one of the asks, and that's the interesting thing about independence, is, you know, they do tend to be very constituency-based, though it's interesting to see that they have the two policy issues that we're bringing to the table are housing and disability. But one of the big issues for Jackie Healy-Rae was a pier in Cremorne. So we had to do a trip down to Kerry to visit Cremorne to see where this pier was required. And there was a theatre almost on the beach where, just as the minister landed onto the beach, a tractor was seen hauling mussels out up through the sand to illustrate graphically the need for this pier. Now, I have a feeling the pier has yet to be built. I could be wrong, but as I know, as of 2017, it still hadn't been built. But nonetheless, it was... in some ways, I opened the papers today and kind of went, Healy Ray is getting a ministry. Where did that come from? But actually having seen just the atmosphere and the standing that Jackie, the father, had in Clorgan and the wider area that day. I mean, it was some experience, actually.
It's an extraordinary... You would not envy, I'm sure, every other politician in Kerry at the thought of a Healy Ray ministry, thought of them going into government.
That was the big issue at the time. People said, oh, were the independents hard to manage? The people who were difficult to manage were the Fianna Fáil backbenchers who shared constituencies with the independents because they were getting credits. But if I could say just one more thing on the government formation, like I see talk of, you know, who gets Fianna Fáil get 8 ministries, Fine Gael get 7 ministries, maybe to weave a line through a couple of the themes we've had today. I'd much prefer to see a discussion about whether we could have 8 men and 7 women at cabinet, as Women for Election called for this week.
Okay.
I think it would do a lot in terms of the standing that women have in society. You opened the programme with those horrendous statistics around violence against women. And I think it would also be of enormous benefit to the tone and tenor of our politics, which would have a significant effect in pushing back on that right-wing ideology and right-wing thinking that we see coming from the likes of Musk and others.
Are you not stereotyping women there?
No, I'm saying that having a government that truly represents the population is far more likely to produce results policies that truly meet. And it is the case that people bring different skills. It's the same thing happens in policing. When you have women in a public order unit, a public order situation is far less likely to escalate.
Okay.
So it is a different skill set. It's a different manner. It changes the tone and tenor of the discussion.
Gerd, would you disagree?
I don't disagree, but it's not going to happen. We don't have a doll that represents our population. We barely inched forward in terms of gender balance in this election. Is it 27% of our TDs are women? I hope I haven't gotten that wrong. It's not a great deal more, for sure. So you're not going to get 50% cabinet out of a doll that's 26% or 27% women.
And I think it's really interesting around the time of the European Commission, like when we were submitting our applications for Commissioner, which is now Michael McGrath, Ursula von der Leyen, you know, she was kind of insisting everyone needs to put forward two representatives, you know, you need to put forward a male option and a female option. And Fianna Fáil were kind of, no, Michael McGrath is our man, we won't be. But also, who were they going to put forward? They only have one cabinet minister, senior cabinet minister, who's a woman. If they put Norma Foley forward, they would have no other women left at their cabinet table. Like, it's kind of astounding.
Okay. Graham, you were looking at the poll in the Sunday Indo. If you want to start talking about it, and then whatever information I need to give about it, I will interject to give, okay?
Yeah, I mean, final thing on women in office. I mean, they're also on the receiving end of this toxic internet culture, as many studies have shown, specifically here in Ireland. But no, I mean, what was striking about that poll is it suggests there is a bounce for the winners, as the headline says. But
okay, you know, so just pause. So the state of the parties, according to this poll, is, and this is taken on Friday and Saturday, January 10th and 11th, so that's the Friday and Saturday, yesterday and the day before, 1,206 sample size and plus or minus 2.9% margin of error. And look, this poll suggests, and again, snapshot in time, fuzzy ranges and everything, they have Fianna Fáil up 1.9% since the election at 23.8%, Fine Gael up 1.5% at 22.3%, Sinn Féin up 0.3% at 19.3%, Independents and Others down 6.7% at 8.8%, Social Democrats up 2.5% at 7.3%, Aintu up 1.4% at 5.3%, Independent Ireland up 1.3% at 4.9%, Labour down 0.9% at 3.8%, Green Party down 0.7% at 2.3%, and Solidarity People Before Profit down 0.6% at 2.2%, and on you go.
Well, it shows the broader dynamics around this government formation, where for the first time since 2007, you won't have a centre-left sort of mudguard party to both push the main parties and to do more on various things like climate change and other progressive items, but also to take the flak for those decisions as well. So you're seeing a very interesting dynamic emerge. And I think what we will see is action on disability, because everybody from Independent Ireland to the Social Democrats wants a minister for disability. And it's in many ways an issue which crosses almost all of our lives in the entire political spectrum. But what's really interesting...
Does this talk not happen at every election? And like, people who've been in this game a long time will say that, yeah, I hear this every election and nothing really changes.
But also everybody knows, because again, all of our lives have been touched by disability, that the rhetoric is not bringing the supports which everyone has a right to, you know, in this country. And, you know, it's interesting that they've concluded their agreement on mental health and disability. And mental health is to be seen under a disability lens. But, you know, again, whether it'll deliver for everybody, you know, in their own real lives, I think will be the kind of thing which will be a test for this government, because it came up on the doors. The Kanturk incident was about it. You know, we need, you know, Simon Harris was being engaged by someone who was working in the sector, right? So we might see progress on that. I just fervently hope we will. But we will probably not see progress on climate change. And that's what's interesting about the coverage of this poll. So page 8, Kevin Cunningham, who did the poll, right, talks about the winner's bounce, but the stumbling blocks include... If they slack off on climate change, and this is a quotation from him, it would direct the government far away from the median voter and play into the hands of the opposition. So if the poll also shows that people don't want to see roads privileged over public transport, although they want public transport that works. And you know, not surprisingly, in view of the Independents' role in this future government, they don't want to see particular constituencies prioritized either.
The poll suggests that, like, as a snapshot.
So they suggest that.
The top of their heads off.
So this is a potential pitfall for the government if they're, you know, seen to be going too far into the particular demands of particular independence. But it's down to us, the voters, to hold them to that. If we do care about certain causes, we have to hold them to it in polls and also when we actually vote.
And Sarah, on certain causes, like, look, there really is kind of only one issue when it boils down to it: housing, housing, housing. Again, the poll today suggests which of the two following issues should be the two most important, or which of the following should be the two most important priorities to deal with. Housing way out ahead in this poll, but as it is consistently at 51%, cost of living below that at 31%, healthcare at 30%, immigration 20%, and climate change 10%. It's all about housing, isn't it?
It's always about housing. And I think the kind of interesting thing is, like Jared kind of alluded to, that a lot of kind of government formation at the point, government formation talks at this point, is kind of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael agreeing on what they both believe they are doing a good job on. So they're sitting down at the table and saying, exactly, I agree with you. And I think housing is one of those areas where they both feel like they're genuinely doing a good job. Now, don't get me wrong, there has been a commitment to significantly ramp up housing delivery, and you know,
the numbers are going in that. Into it,
yeah, but I suppose, you know, it's still public issue number one. And I'm just wondering, if Dara O'Brien is likely to stay in the housing portfolio. It's understood, you know, a lot of people in this poll are saying that they would like to see Pascal Donoghue have a go at it, that they think it should change hands to Fine Gael. But either way,
with Dara O'Brien a close second.
Dara O'Brien a close second. But, you know, I suppose like the kind of interesting thing about housing is nothing has changed on it, public sentiment, but also, you know, the government's attitude. They think they're doing a good job, and I don't think anything is going to change in terms of housing policy in this next government. I don't think there will be, you know, any kind of, I think they think housing for all is working, even though it has been proven to have an inflationary effect on housing.
Well,
prices.
They would dispute that according
they
to who you listen to. Yeah,
they would. Yeah. But I suppose the kind of the more things seem to change, the more they say the same is the kind of overwhelming feeling I've gotten from this poll on housing.
Okay. Thanks to our panel today. Graeme Finlay, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Advisor and Irish Times columnist. Sarah McGuinness, Political Correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. And Sinead McSweeney, former Global Head of Public Policy at Twitter. Thank you very much, guys, for a great hour there. And now we'll go to the newsroom.